Josie, I am sick and tired of talking about these grubby little humans and their UNSC and their demons. Can we talk about those who walk the path, please? What say you?
We have been talking a lot about the Spartans, but also I just want to remind you that our first episode that wasn't talking about Infinite News was about the Huragok.
True.
So it's not like we haven't been not talking about the path.
Well, I think we owe some to those on the path of transcendence, though. I think we need to talk specifically about them.
Never struck me as a true believer of the Great Journey, but all right, go off, I guess.
Well, we're in luck, because we're doing a book club today on one of our absolute favorite books of all time. It's completely Covenant-centric. It is Broken Circle by John Shirley.
It is easily one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
One of the most books in the series, if I might say so.
It is. It is easily one of the most books.
Broken Circle takes place, it has two parts to it. The first part is right at the founding of the Covenant, and then the second part is around the time of the Great Schism, so near the tail end of Halo 2. So it's got a good variety of characters and topics and places and such. It's a very, very fun book.
Yeah, it really does bookend the Covenant with...
Ba-dunts.
Ba-dunt. But, like, it does. Like, the very beginnings we see, the formation of the Covenant, and then, of course, as we all know, with the Great Schism, the end. So what we're going to do in this episode is focus on part one.
Yes.
Josie and I recently reread the book. It's a longtime favorite, as we just said. I actually slept on this book for a really long
time. You did. I had to yell at you to read it.
He did, guys. Like, he had to get on my case about not reading this. It was... I fully agree with you now. I was all about the human stories. I didn't have as much interest in the alien-only stories. It just wasn't up my alley. But then, yeah, I read it, and it's easily top three for me now.
I had a fight to get you to read it and see how much you like it now.
You did.
I don't want to read about the Covenant. Yeah. I want my Spartans.
I want Spartans and Oni. I love them.
You're going to get Sanchayum and you're going to like it.
Yeah, he was right. I did. But not only that, like, I've said this before, I think probably 100 times, but John Shirley, I think he is the most technically gifted writer out of all of the Halo authors. Like, obviously, we love Nyland and we love Denning.
Oh, absolutely.
We love Gay. But, yes. Like, we, Shirley's pacing and his vocabulary. I'm not going to sit here and recite all of the words that I wrote down, either that I really loved or I actually had to go look up because I didn't know what it meant.
She has a lot of praise.
I have lots of words that I just made a list because I was like, this is a Broken Circle vocab list. These are wonderful words. He's really a really talented writer, just from a technical point.
There's so many point of view characters and, like, perspective shifts in the early chapter, actually throughout the whole book, and it just flows very well. It doesn't feel abrupt when you go from the Sangheili to McKen and High Charity, and it's just, it just flows. That's the best way I can describe the writing.
Yeah, it really takes a lot to be able to juggle those perspective shifts. You're totally right. And sometimes, you know, when that is happening in a book that you're reading, you find yourself wanting to read one part more than the other part, and so that every time you go to the part that you don't want to read, you're like, oh, okay, I gotta like slog through this a little bit. But that was never the case here. I was equally interested. I was like,
yeah,
oh my god.
Yeah. I was always happy when the perspective shift from one group to the other, but I still wanted to continue reading about the group that we just left.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the flow was really good.
And on top of that, like, the way he writes the characters, you can, like, really infer their voices. Every character is unique.
Yeah.
Like, extremely so. Like, none of them overlap, which is really nice, because a lot of Sangheili and Sanchayum and, like, a lot of the alien characters are kind of written one note, oftentimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really good to just have, like, each character being a character. It's super nice.
Absolutely. Well, so let's jump into it. Let's jump into the prologue, the opening scene.
The War of Beginnings.
Yeah. So we're in 860 BCE at this point. This is actually during the Sanchayum-Sangheili War, which, as you said, is the War of Beginnings.
The quick summary for the prologue is that the Sanchayum and the Sangheili both worship the Forerunners. The Sanchayum were open to experimenting with technology, but the Sangheili only, like, worshipped it, and, like, it's sacred, you don't mess with it, you just leave it alone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the two cultures met, they clashed, and this led to the war beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
In the prologue, we follow a prophet named Mekhen Scriabin. He is on the planet of Red and Blue, which, thanks to the Halo Encyclopedia of 2022, it has a name now. It's Anvaral.
Anvaral.
So that's cool.
Yeah, it was like a one-off mention in his bio.
Yeah. So the Sangheili and the Sanshum are kind of like in a race to grab whatever forward artifacts they can on Anvaral.
Mm-hmm.
And we're basically seeing Mekhen kind of like oversee the operations, and then the Sangheili launch a counterattack that almost gets him killed.
Mm-hmm.
And the counterattack was led by Usa Zalis, who is the focus character from on the Sangheili side. So it introduces our two protagonists for the first half of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Mekhen Scriabin on the Sanshium and Usa Zalis on the Sangheili side.
Yeah, excellent breakdown. And Mekhen is described as being, like, very, right from the start, he's shown to be more, like, a more thoughtful Sanshium than we're used to. And this kind of goes back to what you were saying about character voice a little bit, because, mm-hmm. We're talking about a book that's, like, half Sanshium. The Sanshium we know mm-hmm. going into this book are bastards. I don't want to read about that. But, like, right from the start, Mekhen is shown to be, he kind of muses about, like, what the Forerunners would actually think about them fighting the mm-hmm. Sangheili, because they're clearly just as devout to the Forerunners as the Sanshayum are. They just go about it in different methods. And so he's just shown to be a little bit more already, like, open-minded about, especially about when with Usa, thinking that he could be pretty instrumental in striking a peace, maybe.
Yeah, at first he wants to mark Usa for assassination, but he thinks about it for a second and says, no, we could use him later on.
Yeah.
Let's not kill him.
Yeah, I really like that part. Yeah.
We don't see anything from Usa's point of view in this chapter, in the prologue, but a lot of it is from Mekhen's point of view, and he kind of describes Usa and says, like, he thinks outside the box, but he's, like, kind of traditional for a Sangheili.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also unorthodox in that he's a lateral thinker.
Yeah, it's a good intro to both of the mm-hmm. the main characters here.
Yeah.
One thing that made me laugh, another mm-hmm. thing that John Shirley does so great is humor. There is so much humor in this book. Honestly, some of it's subtle, some of it's overt. But there was this one. Mekhen has a guard, a Sanshayim guard mm-hmm. there. And all of the honorifics that they throw around, your insights shine like the hub of the galaxy, my lord. Or, you know, like, it is a privilege to obey, high lord. Like, no matter what order Mekhen gives, there's always this, like, mm-hmm. flowery response. So then, like you said, like, they're under attack by Usa's forces. And Mekhen's like...
Mekhen basically just says, shut up, just do it.
Yeah. He's like, get in the escape pod. And the guy's like, it is an honor to obey you. Just do it, he says. Just shut up and do it. So it's really funny. He's not one to, you know, stay by rigid protocol if it means, you know, surviving. Mm.
And later on, in a lot of the interactions that Sanshayim have with one another, like, their honorifics and their, like, specific sign language...
Yeah.
It all seems just incredibly petty, too.
So
like, all
petty.
These honorifics they throw around.
Yeah.
Like, it's fantastic.
Yeah. So passive-aggressive and underhanded, and, the politics in this book are a joy.
It's like, basically, if a prophet tells you, like, with respect, they mean, I hate you.
Right. Yeah, we'll get into a little bit of that, definitely, mm-hmm. as we get later in the book. That's the prologue. It introduces Mekhen and Usa, and then we jump to chapter 1, and we're now about a decade later, so it's 850 mm-hmm. BCE.
Mm-hmm.
The war is over.
Yay!
Yay!
And the writ of union is freshly signed.
Yes, and the covenant is established. So this is pretty cool. We see High Charity is under construction
mm-hmm.
here,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty neat. Mekhen has been elevated to the prophet of inner conviction. And this first chapter, we see them meeting with some Sangheili commissioners on the Dreadnought. And they're still discussing, like, Usa is still rebelling against the Covenant. And
he's been a thorn in their side these past 10 years.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really tense atmosphere, just talking about like the whole rebellion situation. Like the writ of union is just freshly signed, the ink hasn't even dried, and still there's like rebellion and sedition going on Saint Helios. And Usa is sticking to like the whole Saint Helios never surrender. Like this, where the covenant isn't something. It's not right. It's not something that Saint Helios should be doing.
Yeah.
And like the Saint Helios and the covenant are like really adamant about saying like, no, we didn't surrender. We just, truce. It's not a surrender.
Right.
But the Usa and his people like absolutely disagree with that, and that's like the big point of contention.
Right. Like, and even the Covenant Saint Helios who McKenna's meeting with, there's still that like a little bit of tension. I mean, they're devoted to the cause of the covenant, you can tell, but McKen still notes that there's like a little bit of tension there.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of the Saint Helios in the covenant are kind of like resigned to their position. Like they're inwardly not the happiest that they have quote unquote not surrendered, but they know they're better off not arguing it.
Yeah. There is some meshing of, I think like the promise of the great journey is enough to persuade them to, you know, bend to some of the Sanchayim's practices. And I even think like the main language of the covenant is Sinhili eventually, like way later down on the road.
It does become the lingua franca. Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. And once again, there's a mention about the sacred rings in this discussion.
As there always is.
McKen kind of questions if they actually would elevate them to transcendence. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't see that questioning so often, but he's like, would they? I've been studying ancient texts, and it kind of seems like they might do something else that is not that way.
McKen makes a point of mentioning that he's a scholar, and he reads a lot of texts and literature, and he, instead of like taking them at face value, he tries to truly understand what they mean.
Right.
And he looks past all the flowery language, and that's what leads to him like having doubts.
Right.
But he keeps them to himself because he's not supposed to question or like read into things. You know, you're supposed to accept the writings and the truth as it is. And almost every single Sanchayim with a title, their title is the opposite of how they really feel.
Yeah.
So McKen being the prophet of inner conviction, his inner conviction isn't very strong.
Yeah. He even acknowledges that.
Yeah. As far as his faith goes, I think his morals, he sticks to them more than anything else.
I think that's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we get a little bit of setup there on the covenant side of things. And then we do a perspective shift to Usa.
Yeah. So now we get to see Usa firsthand, and we meet him and his mate Sul, who is one of my favorite Sangheili. She's just cool.
Yeah, Sul's great.
Yeah, she's an engineer, she's really smart, she's clever.
Yeah.
So Usa and Sul are in a mining colony looking for like more Sangheili to recruit into their rebellion against the Covenant. And they're not getting a lot of luck. Like, everyone knows, like, yeah, we're not going to openly defy the covenant. That's going to get us killed. But then they meet an old Sangheili named Kreka, who just happened to know Usa's uncle, possibly his father.
Right.
And then he tells them, you know, a long time ago, we found this old world that probably belonged to the gods, to the forerunners. And, you know, it probably has technology that can help you defeat the covenant. And he leads them to Shield World, 673.
Yeah.
And this would become, eventually it's going to become the refuge where, like, all of Usa Sangheili live. Yeah, and then we meet Enduring Bias, the monitor of Shield World 673, who is just a treat.
Yes. Would it really be Halo if we didn't have an eccentric, forgetful, slightly insane monitor in our story?
It would not be as fun, honestly.
Yeah. We do get a little, we'll see more of him during Bias later, but when Kreka does bring them to the Shield World, Enduring Bias is like, oh, hello, I haven't seen anybody or talked to anybody in thousands and thousands of years, but nice to see you. But yeah, Usa decides to bring his followers here and kind of take, quote, refuge. But he's got to get them there first.
Yeah.
So right now they're all in kind of a hideout in the South Pole of Saint Helios.
Mm-hmm.
we're introduced to a young Sangheili, one of our favorites, Tirsa Gunnick.
I love it. Okay, so here's something we talked about a lot. Monica read the book, and I have read it in the past, but I also listened to the audiobook.
Oh, yeah.
Because ADHD brain. So I know how to they pronounce the names, but I don't know how to write them. And Monica has the opposite situation. So Scott Brick pronounces his name Tirsa Gunnick.
Gunnick. There's probably going to be a lot of that because there are so many there are so many names here. There were so many names. I mean, we're not even going to get for half of the characters that were in this. But yeah, like I was so curious. I want to know, Jesse, how did you pronounce this? Gunnick. Tirsa Gunnick.
Tirsa Gunnick.
Love it. Well, either way you spell it or pronounce it, he is a sweet child. And that's...
We love him.
That's facts.
Mm-hmm.
But it just kind of introduces the clan, the Usins, kind of. Mm-hmm. These Sangheili who are rejecting the Sanshayim and the Covenant. And...
Yeah.
You know, they've taken blood oaths to follow Usa. I mean, they're all in.
Mm-hmm. They're all sworn to Usa.
Yeah.
And they're a good bunch, all things considered. Except for that one spy.
Yeah, so there's a spy. The Covenant have a spy in there. Mm-hmm. But Usa is sharp, and he figures it out.
Yeah. It's actually one of, like, my favorite scenes, because Usa, when he takes the eggs that the females are transporting, or taking to the transport, and, like, they mention, like, this is, you know, this isn't a job for Kaidan, but it's a thing a Kaidan will do to show, like, solidarity to his people, and kind of, like, to light a fire under them to get them to work as hard as he is.
Mm-hmm.
And Usa's right-hand man, Ernica the Scarmaker, he's just a big, tough Sangheili. He's really a minor character, but he's, like, a really fun character.
Yeah, you're right.
He's just big and burly and mean, but he's cool.
Yeah.
He tells Usa, like, you know, you're putting yourself at risk doing this, right? What if there's a spy? And then Usa's like, yeah, I know. And then the spy comes up, and Ernica kills them.
Like, oh, that was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Ernica isn't in a lot of scenes, but when he is in the scene, he kind of steals it.
Yeah.
Ernica the Scar Maker. Like, what a name.
He's very Travis Willingham, big dude, but he's pretty nice.
He would be voiced by Travis Willingham.
He would be voiced by Travis,
headcanon. But this scene, it really shows that Usa cares about the future of the Sangheili. You know, he's not just rebelling for his own self-pride or anything. I mean, his goal is to really, you know, regroup and then someday come back to take Sangheilios.
Yeah, it's as much as his pride is in on it, he does it for his people more than anything else. Yeah, and that's the big introduction to both of the protagonists from both sides of the story. And then, so from now, let's just do a quick rundown of McKen's side, and then we'll do a quick rundown of Usa's side of the story.
Yeah, that's smart, because in this book, we're shifting perspectives so much. So we'll just focus on McKen first, and go through his whole story, and then switch over to Usa and his clan.
Yeah.
Agreed.
So a big part of McKen's story is he's struggling with, like, his own morals, and him kind of being forced to be the errand boy for the high prophet of, one of the new high prophets, actually, the high prophet Excellent Redolence, who just likes to be called Excellent, to be honest with you. So it's a lot of, the whole political backdrop of the Sanshiyum and McKen making allies, as many allies as he makes enemies, and McKen's enemies trying to, like, manipulate McKen to do their bidding.
Mm-hmm.
So, the catalyst for McKen's storyline to kick off, actually, is his wife.
Cressenda. So one thing we should quickly say, this group of Sanshayum is kind of like a broken off part of the older Sanshayum, or basically they're kind of in a genetic...
They're a small population, so their genes aren't diverse at all.
Right.
So they have to be very careful about who can breed so that their genes don't, like, go up in smoke, basically.
Right.
So there's this whole thing called the role of celibates, and if you're on the role of celibates, you can't have kids.
Right.
And at one point, McKen was almost on that role, but he managed to get out of it because he proved that he was fine some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
So McKen is allowed to have children, and Cressenda happens to be in that physical state of mind to have children.
Yep. She's in a, what I think they said, it was a rare fertile cycle.
Yeah.
But she's so funny because he comes home, you know, wherever they live in Hygerity.
He comes home.
And Crescenta's like, so, also, he's like, I don't know why I am so attracted to you lately. And, like, he's just, like, been thinking about this. And she comes over and she's like, well, so, I've got something to tell you. I am feeling it. And, you know, our species really needs to reproduce. You're not on the roll of celibates. But she's so funny because she's like, but perhaps you're not interested. And, you know, I'll just prepare your tea and your protein mash. We can talk about High Charity's construction, maybe some paint in our house. And he's like, no, no, no. Hey,
nope,
stop
nope.
teasing me.
Stop that.
Yeah.
We're going to have child.
We're going to have child. Yes. So that's, it's like really cute. There's like a lot of romance in this book too, which is very, very sweet. It really is sweet.
I didn't expect cute Sanshu rom-com, but I'm not mad.
I'm not mad about it either.
Yeah.
Hey, they were sexy at one point, remember?
That's what the Forerunner said. But, essentially, McKen and Crescenta's courting, you know, having of children, tipped off Excellent Redolence, like, to remember, like, wait, McKen was almost on the roll of celibates. Maybe I can use this as some blackmail to get him to do what I want him to do.
Mm-hmm. So the other layer here, is a political rival of McKen's. This, I forget his last name, but it's Renaud is the first name.
Renaud Custo.
Renaud is in charge of a new Ministry of Anticipatory Security, which by the name alone, you can tell, like, okay, that's a little bit bullshit. I just anticipate security risks. I'm going to take care of them, even though they're nothing right now. Like, okay. But Renaud and Excellent Redolence kind of gang up on McKen. They both don't like him. Mm-hmm. And Excellent Redolence kind of funds Renault's this new ministry. It's actually pretty funny because a colleague of McKen's, Quirlam, they were talking about, like, how many ministries do we need? Like, they're talking about all the ministries that the Sanshium have. Anyway, again, it was just really cute and funny. But they come up with this plan to send McKen on a crazy mission to Jandruquam, the homeworld of the Sanshium, to kidnap female Sanshium on that planet from the Stoic side. So the Stoics are the other sect of Sanshium that are still on the homeworld after the reformist McKen and his crew.
Except totally not kidnapped. They're all coming willingly.
Oh,
now.
Right. That's true. Thank you for correcting me. They totally, although you're not wrong, like, they did send a message to the females on the planet to say hello.
Originally there was a plan to kidnap them that McKen shot down.
That's
and
correct.
This is a revised plan where it's consensual now.
Yes, and the kidnapping plan was Renault's plan. And when McKen shot that down, this is now like payback. Be like, "Oh yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. Well, I'll send you on the mission instead. You bastard." Yeah. Also on Jandruquam is an artifact and then a possible luminary.
Ayo.
So there are many reasons to go to Jandruquam. And they basically threaten him, don't they?
Yeah. Hey, do what we ask you to do. You're going to be put on the roll of celibates. We know Crescenta's looking up pregnancy. So she's researching what to do if she gets pregnant. But if you're on the roll of celibates, that's illegal.
Mm-hmm. And in this discussion, what follows is probably my favorite moment of all of Halo. We've talked about it before.
We've mentioned it, but go on.
I love this. It is the funniest moment to me in the entire Halo universe. Basically, Excellent Redolence gets really upset, and he just, like, slams his fist on the arm of his anti-grav throne. And it, like, sprays up a bunch of holographic symbols, and then it also makes the throne turn in the air, like, rotates once in the air.
He's just spinning in midair.
And McKen is like, I know I shouldn't laugh. Okay, I'm just gonna pretend that didn't happen. And everybody pretends, even Renaud has to, like, you know, like, restrain from laughing. You can tell he's like, oh god,
yeah,
this is so funny.
Yeah,
it's just as entertaining now as it was the first time I read it. Very funny. So eventually, you know, because they're threatening him, McKen's like, fine, I will go do this thing. So that's where they end it. One thing I want to mention, the Sanshium, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but they have kind of a sign language, right?
Yes.
like sometimes they'll make like the description will be like they made a gesture that meant X, Y, Z or something. Yeah. Like it puts the words that they're saying into more context.
It's also ridiculously extensive. Like there are signs for like, I will do as you say. And also like, I will do as you say, because I know better not than not to.
Right.
It's like, there's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of gestures that seem like, well, you could have just said that, or like, it's like you kind of like say your inner thoughts out loud, but in sign language.
Yeah, it's really interesting. When McKen is arguing, when they're still talking about this mission, Excellent makes this gesture. It means go silent or die silent.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Like, okay, you're just really extra.
Mm-hmm.
Although I kind of want that on a t-shirt. Go silent or die silent.
With excellent redolence on it.
Yeah. It's very metal.
We'll add that to the merch list.
One thing we didn't talk about is excellent redolence. You know, redolence means like it kind of smells nice, right? And it's excellent. Mm. Excellent redolence. If that's the case, and prophets are opposite of what their names.
Oh, no. No, thank you.
Yep. I just want to throw that out there because we didn't talk about it. So, you know, that was definitely part of the humor. But anyway, if we do get Sans Chaeyoum in future books, it would be really neat to see these gestures incorporated into that. They were just such a neat layer.
Yeah, it's a really neat aspect of their culture that we don't really see much into.
Yeah, really cool.
So from there, McKen and his team end up leaving for Jam Jakam. They're accompanied by a couple Sangheili and another Sans Chaeyoum. The Sans Chaeyoum is named Vervin, who is totally not at all on the payroll of the Ministry of Anticipatory Security.
Absolutely
and then
not.
The Sangheili, yeah, absolutely not. And then two Sangheili, Loquin, who also is totally not on aforementioned payroll, and a ranger named Vil Kathami, who we also love.
Yes.
And there's a Hurgok named Floats Near Ceiling.
Yes.
So that's the crew that goes to Jam Jakam. And McKen has, like, this real nostalgic episode when he sees Jam Jakam for the first time.
Yeah.
It's described as, like, green and throbbing with life in certain parts, and then other parts are rocky and barren. Which, if you've read the Forerunner Saga, you know that the Forerunners tested one of the halos on Jam Jakam. So it's probably a result of that.
Yeah. McKen, he says, like, he had found ancient text referring... This is a direct quote. referring to the punishment of his people's world long ago for their rebellion against the gods. So it's very likely a reference to Faber's use of a halo ring when the Sans Chaeyoum were rebelling.
Yep.
This, you're so right. Like, it was nostalgia is a weird way to describe it because he's never been there before.
Yeah.
But it feels like it's home.
Yeah. There's nothing else it can be but nostalgia.
The emotion that he feels when he sees the planet from where his species came from is like a million cycles or more of history took place here, where the Sans Chaeyoum emerged from the seas, where they began to farm, build, create civilization, the mother I have never known. Like, it's very emotional for him.
Yeah.
And we talked about this in our Rubicon Protocol episode, but I just really love the depiction of homeworld and colony ties in Halo.
Mm-hmm.
And how emotional they can be for both Human and Covenant, as we can see here.
Yeah, home is important, regardless of who you are.
I think it's really interesting.
And regardless of where that home is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they do make their way to the planet.
They arrive on Jam Jakam.
In secret. They gotta be careful.
In secret. Hey, absolutely in secret, yeah.
They gotta be careful of the Stoic forces there. Mm-hmm. They're trying to evade those, for sure.
Just a quick reminder, but the Stoics are the Sans Chaeyoum who did not wish to tamper with foreigner technology, and were kind of more similar to, like, the ancient Sangheili, where they also just kind of, like, left the gods' technology alone.
Right.
Yeah, so they're not as advanced as the reformists, surely.
Right.
So they, McKen, Loquin, and Vil Kathami, they make their way to this grotto in the jungle of Jam Jakam, where they find the purifying vision of the holy path. Which is like a holo projector that shows the rings and the arc, and it just kind of like strengthens their faith in the great journey.
Right.
And they also find the luminary that will lead them to the rings.
Oh, well, that's special.
Yeah.
How nice is that?
Found exactly what they needed, huh? Yeah. So, at that point, Vervin and Loquin launched their ambush.
Ah, curse your sudden but inevitable betrayal.
Ah, thank you, Alan Tudyk.
Yeah, shockingly, they betray them. But Flitz near ceiling is able to lock them out of the grotto,
mm-hmm.
Where the actual hostile Stoic forces have been trailing them.
Yep.
So they kind of get locked out. Vervin and Loquin get locked out. Pretty sure Vervin dies there.
Yeah, Vervin dies.
Yeah.
And then Loquin gets kidnapped by the Stoics.
Oh, dear.
We'll see him in a bit.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to go fine.
Yeah. So they... they take the Luminary and the Purifying Vision back to the ship, and then they go get the females. They go to a local town, and they rendezvous with the females that they're taking back to High Charity. And they have a big amphibious native creature called an Ilpdor named Herb. Just like a big, like, what, six-legged creature? It's like a big salamander.
Big carnivorous amphibian creature. Yeah, 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 like a big salamander. Just the way that sounds, a big Ilpdor called Herb. Like, it just sounds so funny.
One of the females has tamed it, and they're riding it, and Herb is, like, helping them get out safely.
Yeah.
Herb truly is the best boy.
Yeah. Herb.
But, on their way back to the ship, they are attacked by a Folasteed Patrol, which are, like, these... gene-modified plants. It's like shrubs, vines, bushes that kind of like are they're a steed, they're a mount. The Stoics ride them.
Yeah.
And it's really weird. Not in a bad way, but like a culture that doesn't follow the same technological paths as the Forerunners. How are they gonna advance? Like, what's their technology gonna look like? Plant modifications.
Yeah.
And like semi-sentient plant animals, creatures.
Crazy.
Really neat.
I remember the first time I was reading this, and I felt like it was reading a different book. Like, I was like, what? Plants are alive?
Yeah.
And they're just like horses? They're just forming into like steeds? Mm. What is happening?
I've always said that Halo is science fantasy, but this is like just fantasy.
Yeah. You're totally right.
It's really cool.
So cool. I mean, that plus the Ilpdor, like, it the really... Ilpdor. I mean, it's just a wild world. It's just really cool. Changerquam's really neat.
Then we see Loquin again, and he gets ripped apart by the Folasteed.
Like, the vines take him and rip him apart.
Yeah.
Into steaming chunks, I believe was the description. And that mental image stayed with me a long time.
It's a brutal way to go. But, I mean, A, you're in bed with excellent redolence, you don't get what's coming to you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
But he had told the Stoics what was going on with this town, where they're getting the females, and that's how the patrol knows where they are. And there's a big firefight that breaks out. There was actually a line that really struck me. I really liked it. But it says something like, somebody threw a plasma grenade, and... the description was like the blue-white incandescence was like mocking the dark green of the foliage or something. And I just loved the contrast there. Just, again, just one thing I remembered.
That's a nice line.
But they are able to escape. They take some, they do take some casualties. I think there was like a random Sangheili that died. So they are able to escape. They make it to their drop ship, and they're able to get to the Vengeful Vitality. Which is up in orbit. So they've got the Luminary, they've got the artifact, Purifying Vision of the Holy Path, and they've got the females. And I think Renault was like, oh my god, I'm somehow gonna go home and not throw this in Renault's face.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing, but it was really funny. But it's not to be.
Done.
Not to be. So the Stoics fire a missile from the planet. It damages the ship. They lose the Luminary through a hole in the ship. It goes flying out.
An unfortunate series of events involving someone not being where they were supposed to be.
Yeah.
And a concussion. It's really sad and preventable, but like, what are you going to do?
Yep. Well, darn. They can't get to the rings now. What a bummer.
Yeah.
The Covenant can't get access to the rings. Well, shoot. Yeah. So the last little bit with McKen here, we see him get back to High Charity. Excellent is a just a bastard. He's
a rat.
Yeah. They kind of, so McKen tells him, hey, you know, we had some people who tried to kill me and Vil, and we can, you know, attest to that here.
Yep.
And Excellent looks at Renault and he's like, how dare you? I can't believe you did that. And Renault's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Excellent Redlands is doing anything he can to save face. It's really
funny. Oh, yeah. So he's punished for the attempted murder, Renault. Mm-hmm. And at that point, a new report comes in that Usa Zelus has been found.
Mm-hmm.
In a shield world. We'll discuss how they know this in just a bit.
Yeah. But, you know, who better than to go get Usa Zelus than McKen himself, who previously met Usa Zelus.
Poor man.
Yeah, he needs a break.
Yeah. Just let him go hang out with Grisenda. Who is actually, at this point, they note that she's helping the females adjust to the new life on High Charity.
Yeah. Which is really sweet.
Yeah. There was, like, a little mention of how the females were like, so do all of the Sanshayum on High Charity look like you? Because you're kind of weak. You guys just sit in thrones all day.
Funny enough, McKen's actually one of the most physically, like, healthy Sanshayum on High Charity because he actually does exercise and works out. And he's still frail and, like, a twig, but he's not atrophied.
Yeah. The trade-off there is like, well, these Sanshayum will be nice to you. The Stoics were not that great to them.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
Yeah. But with that, we leave High Charity and we go to the Refuge.
Yes. Let's talk about the Usans.
Mm-hmm. So, the shield world that they're on, which they just refer to as Refuge from here on out.
Yeah.
It's not finished. It's one of the newer shield worlds, one of the last ones that was constructed. It has some interesting capabilities that we'll see soon enough.
It's described like Requiem, actually.
It kind of is described like Requiem.
Mm-hmm. There's like an outer shell.
Yeah, an outer shell around a rocky world.
Yeah.
It's not like the Onyx kind of shield world where it's in a slipspace bubble.
Yeah, it's more like Requiem. There's like a there's like an outer surface, and then I think the planet is hollow inside.
Yeah, yeah. The planetoid itself is also hollow, so there's like layers.
Right.
Yeah, so the Usans are surveying the shield world to try and like figure out how it works, how they can set up shop and live there. And for most of this section, we follow Tirsa. Tirsa really is the point of view character more than Usa or Sula or any of the other Sangheili.
Yeah.
It's kind of like we're seeing these great leaders through the eyes of just some kid.
Yeah. Which is fun, actually.
Yeah. It's one of the like few times we follow like a young Sangheili other than Legacy of Onyx, the Jewel Amdama's son. Well, he's one of his sons. So it's a really neat perspective from like this he's a kid and he doesn't know a lot, but he's got the spirit. He's there.
He's got the spirit. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good kid.
He's a good kid.
Yeah. So Enduring Bias and Tirsa talk about this thing called a Great Disassembler that can break the shield world apart into, like, separate pieces and, like, use that as a means to hide. And Tirsa is thinking, like, will that kill us exploding the whole world? And Enduring Bias, like, I don't know, what a fun idea, though, right? And then he departs.
Experiment.
Yeah. And then we get the classic line from Enduring Bias. Good algorithms to you, young Sangheili.
Yeah. When he has to go, Enduring Bias is like, I think he says something, I have to depart your oh-so-enjoyable company. So good algorithms to you, young Sangheili, and he scoots off.
Enduring Bias is like absolutely eccentric.
Yeah, there's a lot that Enduring Bias has forgotten over the years, mm-hmm. or wasn't meant to know, one of the other.
Compartmentalization.
Yeah, some of that, but also just like gaps. I think they call it gaps in his knowledge. And you can tell the shield world was not finished. Like, so there's a lot of mystery around, like, what some of these artifacts do, what does this do, and I think even Tirsa, like, sees Enduring Bias with a holo projection, like, with a simulation of the planet coming apart, and he's like, what's that? Yeah. Yeah, again, like, seeing it through Tirsa's eyes and just kind of learning as he learns. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a cool note. We go to Usa at some point, and he's kind of reflecting on Enduring Bias. Mm-hmm. And Usa, I think they, like, spy or something. They have, like, somehow he knows that the Sanshayum on High Charity have, I'm going to quote here, a damaged distributed intelligence, a thinking device they call the Oracle. It was rumored to be mostly mute, only on occasion relinquishing sacred clues. Like, what could that be?
It's our boy, Mendicant Bias.
Mendicant Bias reference here. And yeah. I get, and like, not only did John Shirley, you know, write a good book, he did research. He knew. Like, he already mentioned, like, we already talked about him referencing the Halo Ring attacking Chandra Kwom. Like, and here we are, a Mendicant Bias reference.
Yeah.
So it, good.
Even just like the smallest connections, like the tiniest threads between the different novels and stories and plots, it feels nice.
There was absolutely no reason that Usa needed to know that or anything at all, but it was just that extra, like, just supplementing the story with other things that are already established in the lore. So love it.
Yeah,
love it. But not all is good
on Refuge.
There's stirrings of tension and rebellion, especially by one Salus Krolon. Is that how you pronounce it, Josie, in the audiobook?
Salus Krolon. Yeah, that's how it's pronounced in the audiobook.
Cool.
Yeah.
And his super stable, not crazy at all, pal, Drem.
Yeah.
These two are troublemakers.
They certainly have doubts about Usa's ability to lead, but he would never, ever voice those doubts out loud. Salus Krolon? No, he would never show any sign of doubt to the great Usa Zalus. He's a little rat. Like, his whole thing is he's just a traitor and a coward.
Yeah, they are like, how Usa has doomed them all kind of thing. But he would never say that. Krolon would never. It's not Krolon who thinks that. He's just wondering.
Not at all. It's a lot of them intentionally misrepresenting what Enduring Bias says,
yes,
and using it to stir doubt amongst the Usins. What really, it doesn't go further than Krolon's little group of lackeys,
right?
Thankfully,
like Tirsa is just there. Tirsa is just he's just part of the group or whatever that was part of with Krolon and Drem that were serving these artifacts. So that's what they're doing. And Enduring Bias is there, and he's like lamenting how incomplete the shield world is, and he's like, I can't fix some of these systems. And then, but just like you said, they misinterpret what he says. Enduring Bias is like, do you have a Hurragok? It would be so nice to have a Hurragok. And they're like, we don't know what that is. And he's like, dang it, well, if these Sansheim that you keep talking about have a Hurragok, I would welcome them to the Refuge. But like you said, Krolon and Drem are like, oh, excuse me.
Oh, you would welcome a Hurragok if it meant it came with the Sancheum. Is that what you're saying? And he's like, I mean, I would like a Hurragok, but I don't really know anything about Sancheum, so I guess whatever, I'm open to them. Yeah, neutral. It's like,
proof that Usa and Sul and Enduring Bias are conspiring with the Sancheum. Yeah. They're going to bring the Sancheum here. Yeah, yeah.
It's very frustrating when, like, someone tries to, like, twist your words to suit their very faulty narrative. But it's also very funny that Krolon is so obviously doing this.
Yeah.
Like, he's not subtle.
No.
He thinks he is, but he's not.
Not at all.
Yeah, so, like, Tirsa hears all of this, and he's, like, witness to it all, but they just keep threatening him. It's like, if you try to take us down, you're coming with us, so, you know. Keep it hush hush, childling.
They haven't been talking traitorous talk at all, but if you say anything, we will make sure that you go down with us.
Yeah.
What? Exactly. Okay, sir. But we meet, okay, Josie, once again, audiobook pronunciation, Lenur Moll. She's a female Sinhili with, I quote, jewel-like gleaming silver green eyes, perfect symmetrical arrangement of her four jaws. Tirsa is in love.
Yeah, love at first sight. It's super cute. Yeah, it's really cute.
It's so cute. He's like, I shouldn't be staring at her, but I can't help it. But it is actually interesting. We get a little bit of a glimpse into gender roles in Sinhili culture. We've gotten this before with other books, but
yeah, it was mentioned in Halo 5, so it's in the games.
Yeah,
too.
Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of it here. Basically, you know, obviously the males are warriors, all that. The females do know basic fighting skills to protect home and egg, which I thought was really cute. So Tirsa and Lenur are chatting, and basically Krolon comes in and insults her and, you know, like kind of questions her abilities or whatever. I don't remember what he said, but she basically says like, well, females do need to know our, you know, rudimentary fighting skills. And he basically is like, that's just an excuse females use who don't know their place. Yeah. And I wanted to just transmat into the book and just kick him, like, so
not,
hard.
Not only is Krillon a seditious snake, he's also a misogynist.
The worst ever. He's the worst.
Yeah. He's terrible.
But Terce is like, how dare you insult my friend? I challenge you. And Krillon's like, you know, no, because I'm just going to go. So he leaves because
he's a coward.
Big old coward. But it does lead to, like, oh, one of my favorite parts in the book where Terce's like, looks at Lenur and he's like, oh, you know, I didn't mean to, like, assume you were my friend. I mean, like, I don't really know you. You don't really know me. I didn't intend any, like, she just goes, well, I think we're friends. And you can be like, you can hear his two hearts through the pages.
Yeah. Tirsa, I love a woman who can kick my ass, Ganok.
Yeah. It's real cute. It's real cute. Yeah. And the next thing we see are they are actually, like, courting. They're, like, walking together.
Yeah. They're going out.
Yeah, they're going out. But during one of their walks, they're talking about kind of how they're going to, how long they think they're going to be here on the Shield World. And they actually make a little bit of a foreshadowing conversation about how the Sangheili are not meant to sit here and study and, like, quote, vegetate, I think, as what Tirsa said. So they have some concern about it. They're like, Sangheili's culture is, they need an adversary. They need something to test themselves again and prove their honor.
They need something to do.
Yeah, they need something to do. It's in their culture.
Mm-hmm.
So this will explain something that we'll get to in part two and later.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was an interesting conversation that they had because it connects with part two.
Yeah.
But while they're on their walk...
Surprise, surprise. What do they hear? More seditious talk.
Oh, great. And who could it possibly be? Krillon and Drem.
Yep.
Essentially, they overhear and Krillon and Drem find them out and they chase them. And Tirsa and Lenur are arrested and they're brought to trial with Usa.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, Krillon and Drem are like, these guys are conspiring against you. You know, trying to save their own skins kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then Enduring Bias swoops in and he's like, so I have surveillance video.
Yeah.
So.
Just a little funny note, Krillon and his lackeys call Enduring Bias the Dark Angel. And it's very dramatic and it's very extra.
That's right. Oh my God. What? So we still quote some of these things. The Dark Angel.
Oh yeah. The Dark Angel. It's Scott Brick really hams it up whenever Drem specifically is like, whenever Drem like sees Enduring Bias like, the Dark Angel slips among us. And it's so, so extra. It's great.
I really want to listen to this book now. Oh man.
Yeah. But yeah, no, Enduring Bias kind of like presents the evidence that Krillon and Drem are liars. Drem makes a break to try to kill Usa and is immediately decapitated by Ernica, and then Krillon is imprisoned. And then he escapes and he takes Usa's ship off the refuge, and Usa is worried that he might tell the Covenant where they are.
What? He would never do that.
No.
Good old Krillon? No.
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 You could trust Krillon.
Never. He would never go to the Covenant and tell them where they
are. Anyway, Krillon tells the Covenant where they are.
Yep, and that's where our two stories converge. This is how McKen is, or this is how the Covenant knows that Usa's alive, where they are, and now they're sending McKen over to kill him.
Yep. So McKen leads his fleet to refuge. He and Usa get on a Zoom call, like, no, literally, like, the whole, can you see me, can you hear me, the whole back and forth, but after the conversation, Usa, like, gets McKen to understand, like, I'm not surrendering, and in fact, I'm taking the whole colony with me. So the negotiations immediately go south after, like, McKen tries to get him to surrender. Usa says no, and here comes the foreshadowing of the disassembly array.
Yeah, so this, I mean, because McKen really does respect him. This is where we've got our two protagonists. These are the two people that we've been rooting for this whole time, and now they're, like, trying to convince each other to do something different. And as a reader, you know that there's no way Usa was going to surrender. But with McKen, you're like, I know you mean well, and you do want to save the colony. And when you say that, because McKen's like, I'll try my best to, like, make sure your people are safe. But you know that he can't guarantee that. And Usa knows it, too.
Yeah. But we also know that McKen wants to do what he can to protect them. Like, he cares about, in his own way, he cares about the Usan colony.
Yeah. He respects Usa. He really admires the bravery and leadership Avusa. Yeah.
So, like, we know that these two characters, they could have come to some agreement. Like, they can see eye to eye, but they don't think that they can trust the other.
Right. It's tricky, too, because as the reader, you're like, yeah. You guys would be friends, I promise. But, like, in the moment, there's no way that this could go any other way than it does. So.
Yeah, so the Covenant ends up invading the refuge. They're pushed back. Also, Krillon gets torn to shreds.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
They brought Krillon in as, like, a way to, like, oh, show us where they are. And then they find him immediately and...
hack him to bits.
Yeah, he's gone. There's a lot of that in this book, actually.
There is. There is a lot of hacking of limbs, yeah.
Yeah. So, the Covenant's pushed back, and then Usa tells McKen, like, you know what? You asked for it. I am not only not surrendering, I am taking the whole colony with me.
Yep. No Forerunner relics for you.
Nope, nothing. You're not getting anything out of this. So, the foreshadowing of the Dissembler, the title, Broken Circle, here it is. They activate the Dissembler Array, the Shield World is torn apart, and McKen is... horrified.
He can't believe it. He's like, he actually did it. He destroyed the world, those relics, the civilians, it's all gone.
But at the same time, he notes that it's kind of interesting how a lot of these big pieces of the colony are kind of intentionally moving to certain points in the asteroid belt.
Yeah.
So he has his doubts, and he's sure that they're all dead, but he thinks it's very interesting that they might not be dead, but who's to say? Not him.
Yeah, he makes the decision not to say anything because he just lets them be. And if they are alive, then he's just gonna turn his head and get back to his life.
Also, the radiation levels were genuinely off the charts and dangerous to explore and to begin with. So
this is another feature of this shield world. This is a very unique shield world. Part of its defense mechanism is that we'll see a little bit of this in part two. It glows with radiation that there's like no way life could be possibly sustained there, but that is a feature of the shield world. So sneaky forerunners.
Yeah. Which I mean, honestly, I think considering that the shield's worlds were meant to protect against the flood, I think even if you broke your world apart, I think the flood is tenacious enough to still get to you. So.
It's an interesting conversation because, like, they were trying literally everything. Because the whole point with the shield world, like you said, is to hide from the flood. Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, you know, it might take them a little longer to find you scattered in an asteroid belt under radiation disguise. But they gonna find you.
Very interesting concept.
Yeah.
But against the flood, you're literally just buying time.
Yeah. I always thought the same thing. I was like, okay, well, that's like, it might buy you time, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's where we end part one, with our two protagonists kind of going their separate ways.
Mm-hmm. The Usins are fine and alive in the now fractured colony, and McKen is heading back to High Charity to spend time with Cressanda and get on with his life.
Yeah.
And any final thoughts for the first half of this book?
Oh, this book, the humor, the romance, the pacing, the politics, the world building, I just love how he'll reference something. Like, they're talking about Tirsa and I think it's Lenir are talking, or maybe it's Tirsa and Krillon, and they're talking about how they're now here at the refuge and they can't turn back. Like, this is their path now. They can't turn back. They've crossed the Great Torrent, is what... And, like, the Great Torrent is described as, like, a mythical river, a raging river that is part of Saenghili myth, and once you cross it, you can never pass through it again.
Yeah.
So, and, like, you didn't have to go that hard, John Shirley. You could have just said, like, we can't go back. You know, but no, I'm going to, like, create this, like, myth and this legend of a river. Like... It's just really, I really, really love. There were so many references to creatures as well. Like, the ship was
Quillic.
Was shaped like a, I don't even remember, a scorer. Like, or, like, later on in part two, it was like, we have to move like a scorkin with its tail on fire. And it's like, what the heck is a scorkin? But it paints the picture. Like, it's just good world building.
It feels very organic.
It feels very real. And, like, you're in the character's head. I thought this book did a great job. And even again, it's very rereadable.
Yes.
It's very layered, and sometimes there are things that I forget, and I'm like, oh yeah, this happened. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I love this book. How about you? Any final thoughts?
My only complaint with the first part of this book is that it's too short, and I want more time with these characters.
Yeah.
They're just really neat and interesting, and I want to get in their heads a lot more.
Yeah, things move fast in the beginning of this book. In fact, that's kind of one of my... It's not even like a complaint. It's a little quibble. No. It just feels like it was very convenient for Kreka to be like, oh, I know this shield world. You should go there. I'm like, oh, well.
Also, I knew your dad. I mean, I knew your uncle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, your uncle. Yeah, yeah. So sometimes there are a couple things. There's also one in part two that I'm like, wow, that was super convenient. So there's just a little quibbles, but easily
overlooked. Hey, that story's writing.
It's part of the story. Yeah. So I think we'll leave it there for part one. I think it goes without saying that we're pumped about part two.
Yeah, definitely.
Part two has just as much, even though it is shorter, it is packed with things that happen.
Yeah, definitely. So if you haven't read Broken Circle, we definitely recommend it.
We can't be friends until you do.
Yeah, that's true. It just almost broke my friendship with Monica because she refused to read it, huh?
I don't want to talk about it. I want to read about aliens only. God, how boring. But there's like no humans, Josie?
You fool.
There's no like... Ugh, that's so boring. I want to talk about Spartans and the... Oh, foolish, Monica.
Yeah.
Foolish.
No, it's a real fun time.
Yeah. Please read the book. It's wonderful.
But for now, we'll leave you guys with that, and we'll be back with part two.
Yes.
An Invitation to the Dance of Chaos.
Ooh, love it. See you then.
See you later. Bye.